when DOT wrote his book, Southern Politics, back in 1948, he said that if you understood, really understood the politics of race, you could understand the politics of the South, the central issue, the underlying issue of almost everything. And one of the first questions we like to ask is, one, is that still true, and if not, why?
Well, in the first place, I don't think it was ever true. From 47 back to the early 30s or the middle 20s, as far as I know. It may very well have been that the blacks just didn't exercise their right to vote, and it was an accepted, or weren't permitted to, and it was an accepted fact. But I never heard of race being involved in a political campaign in this state until after the Brown decision, and not much then until the 60 campaign. So I don't know what he bases his analysis on, but I would disagree with that premise.
How about the Frank Porter Graham Withersmith?
That was a communism thing, so far as I recall, and I was rather young at the time. But there was one question raised that I remember, that Dr. Graham had appointed a black to the West Point Academy. But other than that, I think the Graham campaign was a campaign based primarily on the so-called communist front organizations that Dr. Graham had supposedly belonged to, and that and many of his progressive ideas, which were considered at that time to be have communistic leanings and all. That's what I remember about the Frank Porter Graham campaign, and I was for Dr. Graham, so I don't think race was a dominant issue as far as I was concerned. Now, the second part of your question is, what role do I think it plays now? Well, it plays a role. Its race is exploited by both the liberals and the conservatives. As a black man sat here in this office this week and told me that he had always supported. What I was saying is that they use it for their convenience. John Winters, who's ran for the Senate last time, and he was saying that he wants to run again, but he and Al Adams, and Al is a great liberal, and had always prided himself on being able to manage the black vote. But John was always telling me the other morning how shocked and surprised he was to learn that I was always saying I got the nigger vote in my back pocket. And give you one other illustration. 1965, 1966, 1967, I introduced a bill to make East Carolina a university. Governor Moore and the university crowd fought it, and their strategy was to make all of the former teacher colleges regional universities. That would have been Appalachian. Well, I came back and said make Appalachian, Western Carolina, and Eastern Carolina a regional university. And during the debate of that in the Senate, I got a call from Dr. Helen Edmonds, whom you both will recognize as being one of the outstanding black professors at NCCU. And she at that time was one of the three rulers of ruling, whatever you call them, of NCCU. They didn't have a president. She called me from the White House, 6 o'clock in the morning. She said, "Mr. Morgan, I couldn't sleep a wink. I want to tell you what they're trying to do to you." Said they had a meeting in the governor's office yesterday with Dr. Friday and Dr. West, who's chairman of the Board of Higher Education, Mr. Watts Hill Jr., some of the legislators. And their strategy to defeat your proposal is that they've already sent out a word from the higher board to ask all state colleges to come in and ask to be made a part of the regional university. And the words that they used were that if you opposed it, they would label you as a racist, and that would finish your political career, even if you defeated them and kept them from coming in. And if they were able to get the amendment through, that you would then defeat the bill or table the bill yourself. And she says, "I want you to know that the Board of Trustees at NCCU would not go along with it, and we adopted a resolution." And says, "I want to bring it over with me tonight because I don't think Senator Claude Curry will file it with the committee." And by the way, he did not until I filed it. But the resolution said something like this, that this is not the first time we've ever been asked to set sail with the political winds. It said, back in the 30s, when a black wanted to get into the School of Education for a PhD degree at the university, they instantaneously created a PhD program at Durham, at Central. Later, when somebody wanted to get into law school, they immediately gave us a law school without any qualms about our qualifications. And said, now they want us to set sails with political winds again, not for the purpose of properly designating us as a university, but for the purpose of defeating East Carolina's bid. Well, make a long story short, they offered it. And I made that argument. I quoted that on the floor of the Senate, and the Senate defeated it. Then Jim Exum from the Greensboro, who was known as a rather extreme liberal, leader of the liberal group, led the fight to put A&T University, A&T College, into the bill. And he was successful. And after he had gotten his amendment adopted, and they adjourned for the afternoon, I went over to see Jim, and I said, "Now, Jim, we better get busy and count heads to make sure we've got enough to pass our bill tomorrow." He said, "Oh, I'm going to vote against the bill." I said, "I thought you were arguing for A&T to be a university." And I said, "Wasn't that what you were doing?" He says, "Oh, I'll put arguing for that, for trying to get it in, so kill the bill." I said, "You are a racist son of a bitch." I said, you are the damn people that sit around and call everybody else rednecks and racist, but you don't fail to use it when you want to. And so and he's running now for Supreme Court justice, and I suspect that will be remembered. But you see, race is an issue now. Not like it was 10 years ago when it was an issue all over the country. But I really don't see it as a major issue in this state anymore.
Was it a major issue in the Helms race or in the Wallace presidential primary?
I think you'd probably have to say that it was a major issue in the Helms race, because not so much of his campaign at the time, but because of his long record of editorializing against integration and busing and et cetera. And I'm not so sure that Wallace's, while I think everybody would have to concede that Wallace, the race issue was in the back of Wallace's original campaign, but I think Wallace's campaign finally ended up as being anti-establishment as much as a racist campaign. People just were tired of the ends. And so while it was maybe had its origin in it and still had some overtones from it, I don't think it was as much a racist campaign as it had been in 64, whenever it was he ran before.
Do you see it as an issue in the future?
No, well, to say no, I don't think I'd be telling the truth, but to see it as a major issue, I don't think so.
Do you see anyone putting together in North Carolina the abolish vote and the black vote?
Not really, I don't. There were some unusual alliances last time, for instance. There were some alliances between the Wallace people and the Galifianakis people, which, you know, normally you would not think. Nick was generally thought of as a liberal, although his voting record sort of seemed to run the gamut of all sides. But I don't really see that prospect.
One of the people we interviewed described the Democratic Party in North Carolina as a whole lot of wings, and no head, and no body. But they thought somebody might emerge in the next few years to pull it together, whatever that meant. How do you see the party today?
Well, we got a whole lot of wings, to be frank about it, but I think any political party that's been in power a long time has. You're already seeing different factions emerge from the Republican Party no longer than they've been in power. We do need, we have got to pull the party together under some kind of leadership, because if we don't, we're going to find ourselves going down to defeat again. I was just saying before you came in here, I spoke to a group last week of people that, well, their questions were along the lines of talked about political prisoners in North Carolina. And I asked them that one of their questions was, don't you think that government is generally held in low esteem or bad repute? And don't you think that one of the contributing reasons or causes is the political prisoners? Well, I tell them I agreed with the first premise that generally right now government is held in low repute. But I said, what political prisoners are you referring to? They said they gave two cases, the Chavis trial and the horse burning case in Charlotte. I said, have either one of you read the testimony of the state in either one of those cases? No. I said, well, what are you basing it on? And your charge, your statement. Well, they were both, these people were political activists. And I said, well, are you now saying that political activists ought not to be held responsible for their criminal acts? And I invited them to come down and take the records out of the Supreme Court and read the transcript of the testimony. And there were other questions, you know, will you legalize marijuana? And I'm not sure that those groups can, some of the groups, I'm afraid, are so far out that I'm not sure that they're going to come under anybody's umbrella. And I think that may lead to the defeat, to the downfall of our party again, is that we've got too many factions who just aren't willing to recognize that there are others who share many similar views but don't share all of their views and aren't willing to accommodate. So I don't know whether, I think we will pull it back together, but I think it's not going to be easy.
Is there any one man emerging at this point that can do it?
Well, I haven't. I never have really followed party leadership to the point of saying, you know, of wanting to be a leader in it or saying that we need a strong leader. And I guess that's because in the past our governor has usually been our leader, for better or for worse. I don't see any strong man emerging right now. I basically think that Jim Suggs is doing a pretty good job. He's surely trying. And I think one of the criticisms of Jim is perhaps the fact that he is not consulting his executive committee every time he turns around. And I think probably Jim realizes that the practical, the realities of life are that if he calls the executive committee together, we may be more disoriented than we are now for the present time. I assume we're not talking for publication until 76 or some other time. You know, the executive committee that was selected last time was selected under your quota system, and some of them, he's got a pretty unwieldy group. And I assume that that's why that Jim is not calling them together, and yet it's causing a lot of dissension. I think if I were Jim, I probably would call them together and take my chances on being able to persuade a majority of them that we were following the right course. But at the same time, Jim's trying to do a good job.
Do you think this 1972 election was an aberration, an accident? Some of the people we've talked to say that, well, the Holzhauser thing was so unusual, so was Helms, because of Nixon, that this will not occur again in 1974. We'll go back and pick up Republican seats in the General Assembly, and in 76, win back the governor.
Well, let me say, I'm not so sure that the Helms matter was a political accident. You got to remember, or at least I think I understand, that from here west has always been, and I say always, for many, many years, has been predominantly Republican. And there are about 44 to 45% of the people in this state who are going to vote Republican, regardless of who the candidate is. Now, I arrive at those figures because if you'll get the election returns and compare the votes that the unknown Republican candidates for the Council of State positions received against well-known and men highly respected, such as Edwin Gill and others, Democratic candidates, you'll find that consistently they got somewhere around 44 to 44.6% of the vote. I conclude from that, as a neophyte, that those people are going to vote Republican, period. Now, in the past, the solid Democratic East has held the party together, has held the Democratic Party in power. They say that, and most from here west has generally been Republican. Jesse Helms has had a tremendous following within the range of Channel 5, which has been primarily eastern North Carolina. He's had a tremendous following for a number of reasons. One, he's talked about the racial question in the schools. He's been against busing. He's been an conservative, which appeals to a lot of businessmen. He's been an anti, in opposition to the Raleigh News and Observer, you know, which a lot of people are. So there are many, many factors. And I'm not so sure about what Jesse Helms would not have taken Senator Jordan or Nick Galifianakis, regardless of who, if it even been an off-year election. There's no question in my mind but what Holzhauser benefited from two or three things. He benefited from the tremendous amount of influence and prestige that Nixon held in this state at that time. He also benefited, in my opinion, from some of the so-called dirty tricks, which I can't help, and nobody else seems to agree, but I can't help but believe, were connected with the Committee for the Re-election of the President. For instance, a few months before the election, the word began to get to the press that Internal Revenue was investigating Governor Scott. And if I remember right, about 13 other members of his close friends who helped raise his money. And I made the statement publicly at that time that it smelled to me, because had they been going to, if it was a legitimate investigation, they would not have waited 4 years, and especially until just before the election. But you remember that the closer the election came, the hotter the leaks got. And in late September, the word was leaked that we were going to be presented, the indictments were going to be presented to the grand jury in September. Then the latest and hottest thing was about October, and that's when the governor called for an investigation on leaks, you know. And lo and behold, they sacrificed the U.S. Attorney, Warren Harding Coolidge. But as soon as the election was over, suddenly they found they didn't have enough evidence to go to grand jury. And I don't think there's any question but what Holzhauser benefited from that. Now, even though that was not directed at Skipper, we all, as Democrats, had to bear part of the brunt for it. So I think Governor Holzhauser's election was partially responsible to that and to some just circumstances that I hope won't happen very often.
What sort of circumstances?
Well, Jim Gardner and Holzhauser were upset at each other. I think the way that we Democrats decided to conduct our campaign, and I don't put all the blame on Skipper because I sat right here and said to Skipper that I didn't think that we gained anything by riding around on the bus together. I think maybe Skipper may have taken it a little further than I intended it. We used to campaign in this state, but in November we'd get a bus, and you'd get to council estate on the bus, and we'd ride down to a district rally, and it'd be anywhere from 100 to maybe 1,000 people, depending on how much work they'd done. And I just felt like that was not the way to campaign, that I thought it was wasting talent, that I thought while Skipper was appearing in the East, I could be appearing in the West, and vice versa. But I think maybe we carried it to the point that we left the impression that we were not campaigning as a team, but we were campaigning as an individual. And I don't think that will happen again. But here again, I say I take as much responsibility for that as anyone else. So there were a lot of things. You know, you can point to a million things and say this is what cost us the election.
So you think the party's going to snap back from 74 and 76?
There's no question in my mind about it, provided we come up with reasonably good candidates.
You were taught by Dr. Layton College, I understand, the law school, and then managed his campaign, sort of associated with him because of that. What is your relationship with him, and how does your philosophy agree or differ from his?
Well, interesting enough, we share a good many common things in our political philosophy. And you got to go back and remember this, that all of the candidates in 1960 were segregationists, except Malcolm Sewell, who had been the Attorney General. Malcolm was the only one who had the courage to stand up and say, we're going to live by the Supreme Court decision. Terry didn't come out for integration. In fact, he came out for preserving the status quo of the schools. Dr. Lake was rather rabid on he very firm in his views, and I think that came from the fact that Dr. Lake was the assistant Attorney General who prepared and argued the North Carolina's position in the Brown case in 1954. And you know, when you do that, when you prepare and work on cases, you become more firmly convinced in your views. But as far as being a liberal, Beverly Lake was generally thought of as a liberal. The only other person, to my knowledge, in the history of this state who has served as a public advocate for the people was Beverly Lake when he appeared quite accidentally and much to the dismay of the Attorney General back in the early 50s against Southern Bell's rate increase. And it's right ironical that his son is now opposing him. And the same man, one of the witnesses testified, Dr. Lake cross-examined him, and then he came back down here for another one, and Beverly Lake Jr. cross-examined him. Dr. Lake was very much of a populist, and still is. His views, I think, were distorted quite a bit because of his views on segregation. And we share a good many views. As I said, might tell you by way of passing, Attorney General called him in one afternoon and said, Beverly, they're having a rate hearing over there tomorrow on Southern Bell, and we're supposed to have somebody over there, and Harry McGaddy can't go. If you don't mind, go over and sit in on it. Well, of course, they didn't know what they were doing, and when they sent him over there and he began to see what was happening, he turned it into a full-fledged rape case. And you go back and read your News and Observers, and they hailed him as a great liberal, great friend of the public. So we share a good many views together.
Do you consider yourself a populist?
I don't know what a populist is, but I guess I would if that's being to the people, it being the things that benefit the people. I consider the role of government, in addition to that of maintaining domestic tranquility, without which, of course, no government can survive. I consider the main role of government beyond that is to do for the people those things that they cannot very well do for themselves. Public education is the first responsibility of government. Caring for the mentally ill, the mentally retarded, the handicapped is a major role, and it's one we have not carried. We had not carried at all, in my way of thinking, until we began under Terry Sanford about 63. Terry Sanford made the first major step forward, especially in the mentally retarded sons. And today it's a shame, it's a disgrace that these people who are committed to our care and custody, most of them against their will, are not being provided adequate medical treatment. 1951, I was clerk of the court and judge of probate court, which meant I had to sign the orders committing mentally ill patients to the hospital. The first person I ever saw mentally ill was a lady brought into my office, and she was severely ill. I signed the orders committing her to the state hospital, and I called the superintendent and said, we have one. He says, I have no room, and I can't tell you when we'll have room. And I said, what in the world am I going to do? And I locked her in the common jail of Harnett County. And the first controversy I have got in the legislature in 55 was over what our failure to provide for these people. There hasn't been a single time since 1951, that day, when we've had a full complement of doctors in our mental hospitals and mentally retarded centers. And even to this day, a good many of them are foreign trained. Now, this is not to say that all foreign trained doctors are incompetent, but I'm saying it's a hell of a note when we say that we'll let you into this state and we'll find you qualified to practice on our patients who are committed by law, but we're not going to let you go out and practice. And they have these different types of licenses, you know, among the general public. And to say that a person who's mentally ill has got to be treated by a doctor that he can't understand, he certainly can't relate to him. And go back, the first time when I was at Chapel Hill, Dr. Brower was teaching me calculus, and he hadn't been out of Germany very long, and I couldn't understand him. And he came up to me on the front row one day and says, what's your name? And I couldn't think of my name to save my life. But what I had been doing, I couldn't understand him, therefore I was sitting there daydreaming, you see. But for us in a state like this, to provide that kind of care is a crime. Now, if you check my voting record in the legislature, you'll find that I was always not only for those programs, but I was generally in the fight for them. I introduced prison reform in this state in 1967 when Governor Moore backed down. Lee Bounds came out with his prison reform bill. Governor Moore said, all right, go ahead. Tom White, who was chairman of the Advisory Budget Commission, jumped up and said he'd resign, go home before he'd vote for that bill that would turn the rapists loose and so forth. Governor Moore called Lee and said, we better take it back. He said, I can't afford to run the risk of having my budget destroyed. So I took it and went forward with it. And I started a jail inspection. And I don't even think I'm boasting, but that's a politician's prerogative is to do that. No, if he doesn't, nobody else is. But what I'm trying to say is I'm about as liberal as you come when it comes to people issues. And when it comes to living by the letter of the law and being a strict constructionist of the laws and the Constitution, I'm about as conservative as you come. And I don't know how else to classify myself.
How do you consider yourself on race?
I think that I am not I wouldn't consider myself a liberal or a conservative on it. I'm not one of these that believe that we ought to lower our standards in our exceptional education program in Charlotte, where we're being sued about, in order to bring them in. I don't believe you ought to make a fanfare about it. I mean, I think you ought to do it without regard to race. We have a number of black attorneys on this staff. We brought in black SBI agents right after we came here, but I doubt you've ever read anything in the paper about it. I didn't call a press conference to announce it. So-and-so's been put on my staff. So my position is that I've tried to consider people without regard to race.
As you think back over the administrations that you've worked with, both as an attorney general and in the legislature, which ones stand out in your mind? I mean, in terms of education, roads, mental health, and so on, over the last 25 years, what's on the list?
Well, you'd have to classify, I was an observer in Carscott's administration. You would have to classify Carscott as a roads man, as well as mental health. Now, he made a $50 million bond issue. At least he was concerned and interested. Governor Umstead was conservative, and he really wasn't governor long enough to make any impact. I think had the Governor Umstead been governor, you would have labeled him and known him as representing integrity in government. But I don't think you would have seen very much progress. But Luther Hodges considered himself a businessman in government, and that's a high-sounding term, and it sounds pretty, but, you know, government is not business. It's good to put into practice the economies and the efficiencies that can be derived from government, but I think you must always remember that the purpose of government is to meet the needs of the people and not necessarily to accomplish efficiency and economy. So while I would not, his businessman in the Capitol doesn't impress me, I would say that he deserves to be labeled as a great governor of North Carolina, if for no other reason, and I'm not saying it's the only reason because I can't recall everything right now, but if for no other reason for his creation of the industrial and technical institutes, which began to make training and educational opportunities available for many people who had not had them. He paved the way for really the industrial development of this state. Then you come on down to Terry Sanford. I think he deserves a great, you'd have to name him the educational governor, but it goes broader than that. First place, he took Hodges's technical institutes and then developed it on into the community colleges, which I think is one of the greatest systems we have. About 90% or 95% of all our people are within commuting distance of a community college today. His accomplishments in public education were great, but I don't think you could enumerate them in a 1-2-3 fashion as much as you could say that his greatest accomplishment in public education was the focusing of public attention on the need to do something about public education. I think his concern for the mentally retarded is an area in which he has not been recognized sufficiently for. And remember, I was not a Sanford supporter in the primary. History will be very kind to Terry Sanford. Unfortunately, our system of government in this state, our government system of giving to the governor a great deal of power, but only through appointments, also serves to destroy him in years to come. Sanford's greatest weakness in this state today doesn't come from the people who are his opponents back in the primaries. In my opinion, it comes from those who supported him who were disappointed in many ways because they didn't get one of the 3 or 4 or 5,000 appointments that came out, or they didn't get the right ones. I know when I went to New Jersey to file for him last year, that it was not the people who had supported Lake who gave me hell. It was the people who had been on him and been his ringleaders. One of them was a man, and I won't call names, but in the West Piedmont County, that it was his county manager, and he almost just disavowed any friendship with me because of it. I sat over at the mansion the night before last with two men from New Hanover County who said to me that Terry Sanford came down and sat down with them and said, I'm in trouble. If I can't split the vote, Lake vote in New Hanover County, I can't win the second primary. And I don't recall the exact words, but the deal was that they would support him if he promised them three things. One was to build a bridge, the new bridge that they got. One was the development of the ports. And the third one. And I said, well, did he perform? They said, yes, he performed on all of them. And then within the same conversation, they were saying they were so glad that he came out for president last year because it gave them an opportunity to show the son of a bitch where he really stood in North Carolina. So you see, it's sort of a, and I asked them why. And they can't tell you why they don't like Terry Sanford. Some of them will say the food tax, and then when you turn right around and say, well, really, would you take it off if you had the chance? And they say no. Terry's lack of support among the public is sort of an enigma, except
that... Well, why is that? Generally, the longer you're out of office as a politician, the more of an aura of statesmanlike qualities you get around about you. People tend to forget the mistakes. You know, they tend to remember what it was you accomplished. Apparently, what you're saying in his case, the reverse...
Except with Terry. And I do not understand it. I cannot understand it because...
How much did he hurt himself running for president?
I don't think he really hurt himself. I think if he had been able to carry North Carolina, that there was a real slim possibility that he could have gotten the nomination if for any reason they could have blocked McGovern on the first vote. It probably did hurt him in the eyes of some people in North Carolina, but to go back to answer your question, I cannot understand it, and I pose that same question to many, many people.
Well, when you come from outside of the state, you always hear about the Sanford machine, or the Sanford organization, or the Sanford wing. Those people who worked in his campaign or his administration. And yet, when you really try to pin it down in terms of strength, it's rather elusive.
Well, I'll tell you this.
I said that.
I know what you mean, and that brings me back to another point. I think maybe one of the things that has had a lasting negative effect on Sanford was that he did bring in a lot of bright young people with ideas, which this state needed. We needed some thinkers. We needed some people who hadn't been steeped in the old traditions. But at the same time, they were rather vicious. For instance, I'll give you a good illustration. In 1963, Sanford did not reappoint the chairman of the board of East Carolina University. Now, you know, a position on the board of a university you don't, at least I never did think you sought. Here lately they do over at Chapel Hill, but I never sought it. And I never dreamed of even being chairman of the board at East Carolina. But it just so happened that Sanford did not reappoint the chairman. The next senior man was Mr. Henry Belt, who had turned it down before because of his blindness and his age. And then I was in line. And I hadn't even thought of being chairman, but the next thing I knew was this bright young crowd around Sanford was saying, look, Morgan was not a Sanford man. We can't have him. So they lined it up, put the screws on, make sure that this old man had declined it one time before, was made chairman. Well, when it came to his attention and to Sanford's attention, what had happened, they corrected it the next year. But they did a lot of that people that way, and they did a lot of their own folks that way. So while I think the idea men were a great help to Sanford, I think they were also a hindrance to him, too. But now, that go further to your question. I think there are two people in North Carolina that can today direct a substantial group of voters in one direction or the other. One of them is Beverly Lake, and one of them is Terry Sanford, and probably for two different reasons. Beverly Lake can do it because of his, he had this great loyal following that sort of stayed with him, and he's now been known as the arch conservative, even those who don't consider the race issue. And the second one is Terry Sanford, because Terry Sanford has more people that he can get on the telephone tonight and say, how about getting out John tomorrow and helping Bob Morgan than any other man. Moore can't do it. Bob Scott can't do it. I doubt that Skipper can do it. I can't do it. Now, I don't mean to say that I can and Skipper can and Bob can call people and get them to get out and work for us. But I'm daring if I believe I can transfer my support to anybody else like those two candidates can, those two people.
Could you go on with your assessment? We kind of stopped at the Sanford administration. Could you give us an evaluation of Moore?
Well, I think Dan Moore was, no, without question, a man of integrity. He wanted to be known as a man of a studying a planning governor, but I've tried several times to get my hands on all the plans, you know, that were made, and nobody has them. I guess I've got more of them than anybody else, but mainly because I've looked around state government and tried to find them, you know. I guess Dan Moore was sort of a slowing down governor, you know, time to sort of slow down and take stock. I think Bob Scott was a good governor. Extremely good governor. Unfortunately, Bob had some people around him who did not reflect well, you know, on his administration. And there were some incidents, you know, which didn't reflect well, such as the Barber parole incident, some of the highways. But when you look what Bob Scott did for the for education, mental hospitals, criminal justice, he helped me get, you know, this bureau. The bureau was nothing when I came here. And the crime lab, we had two men in it, I think. Bob Scott backed me to the hilt on everything I tried to do in criminal justice. Had it not been for him, we wouldn't have had our criminal justice network today, which is, I think, ahead of every other state in the union. We may not be doing as many things as some, but what we've got is more solid than most of them. So I think Bob Scott was a good guy, and I think I wouldn't at all be surprised to see Bob Scott come back someday.
You had a year of Holzhauser. How would you assess his administration?
Well, it's too early, Walt. Unfortunately, for him, and maybe fortunately for we Democrats, he got a few of the same kind of people around him that Bob had around himself. He didn't submit but about one bill to the legislature last time, so you really can't say he had a program. He hasn't done an awful lot different than many of the rest of the governors, except, as I say, he didn't have a program to go forward with, and mainly one of the reasons was they were so skeptical of all the rest of them, you see. I think it's really too early there to assess.
There's a story we've heard about you that I'm sure you've heard, I'd like to comment on. And that was that you were thinking of running for governor last year. And the story, as I heard someone tell me, was a story that you went to Washington and Senator Irvin, in effect, advised you against it, said he was going to step down, and said you ought to wait and run for the Senate.
Well, to use Agnew's words, I hate that, which I shouldn't, that is a damn lie. In the first place, I have never had a political conversation with Senator Irvin in my life. And I doubt that very many other people have ever had a political conversation with Senator Irvin. Yeah, the one time that I ever remember sitting down in Senator Irvin's office was I called for an appointment to go see him on a matter of state, for the state. It was a legal matter, and that's why I went to Senator Ervin rather than to Senator Jordan's office. When I went in, Senator Ervin's desk was full of law books. And as I sat on the other side of the desk and tried to present my problem, it was a state problem, I looked and Senator Ervin was sitting there reading one of his law books. So I very graciously brought my, or tried to be gracious anyway, I'm not sure where I didn't show it. But anyway, I brought my conversation to a conclusion. I went over to Senator Jordan's office. He called Bill, his administrative assistant, named Cochran in, and I got my work done. And as much as I think of Senator Ervin, I just don't believe that Senator Ervin is the kind that very many people can go in and sit down and talk politics to. And, of course, the reasons I didn't run for governor is the first main reason I never wanted to run for governor. I have never wanted to be governor of this state. And that sounds untruthful, but aside from the fact that everybody would like to sit at the head of the table just for sitting at the head of the table. But I've seen governors. I know what it did. I know what it did to Sanford. I know how hell-hacked Dan Moore was. I saw Bob Scott cut up to pieces by his own people. And the people that you put in position, like highway commissioner, CND, and so forth, they are not grateful to you because they feel like, well, hell, he didn't do me any favors. I'm the man that put him in office to begin with. They start running the office for themselves, and the governor ends up catching all the flack from the people are dissatisfied across the state and cutting ribbons. And he becomes an administrator, which I wasn't cut out to be, and I've gotten too much that way here. Now, my first 2 years in office, I argued cases in the courts. But now I can't keep up with the phone calls, let alone